I want all of you to pretend like we're sitting around a campfire, and I'm going to tell you a story. And pretend like you don't know anything about Joseph Smith, okay? And I'm just going to tell you a story, and we're going to weave a tale. And as I weave this tale, I'll explain some things about this man. Okay. To the Latter-day Saints, Joseph Smith is a figure of awesome power, whose aid can mean the difference between health and sickness, life and death, both physically and spiritually. He stands, according to LDS theology, as the head of this dispensation, the restorer of the true gospel of salvation. He is the being whom they will have to pass by to enter the celestial kingdom. Joseph Smith excelled in spiritual things. He fought for his beliefs and those of his followers. Joseph Smith triumphed over all his foes. In the end, killing him did not end his great work and destiny. He loved so well that ordinary mortals regarded him with awe or jealousy or both. Within the past 10 years, a number of authors have presented Joseph Smith as a mystic, a shaman, a magician, and in one instance as Jupiter, the Roman god, stating that if evidence for the life of Joseph Smith had not existed, he would be inclined to classify him as a mythical folk hero. I prefer, let me see, two writers prefer to view Joseph Smith's life and his revelations in the context of the near-death experience, that being Steve Christensen and Robert Fillerup. In the mid-80s, historians revisited Joseph Smith's mystical, magical roots in a number of articles, culminating with the publication of Mike Quinn's Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview. In 1992, Harold Bloom's New American Religion renewed the interest in Joseph as a Gnostic and in interest in Kabbalah and Hermetic mysticism. In 1994, John L. Brook published The Refiner's Fire, and he aspired to unite hermetical tradition to the Smiths and other early converts of Mormonism against the backdrop of New England folk magic. These authors' works have generated much discussion in Mormon scholarly community, arousing the community of many, including myself, to reinterpret their own views of Joseph Smith, to view Joseph Smith's life and mission with an enlightened eye. I would like to perhaps offer a more credible interpretation of Joseph Smith, that of Joseph Smith as hero, specifically a shamanic hero. What I want to suggest is that Joseph Smith is the penultimate hero of Mormonism. His life is seen through his eyes. Those of his biographers, devotional or antagonistic, mirror the general pattern of the hero's journey. Joseph Campbell, one of the greatest mythologists of the 20th century in his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, was able to identify and map out certain life stages in the hero's journey. Campbell has given us a brilliant horizontal map that traces the development of life stages of the composite hero. Roger Walsh, in his book, The Spirit of Shamanism, published in 1992, adds a vertical map of the different levels on which life's aims, games, and journeys can be played. Through use of this vertical map, it is possible to distinguish saints from warriors and sages from power seekers. Walsh has provided us with a method to recognize the universal stages common to all heroes of the time, at the same time acknowledging the different types and levels of heroes, how the hero confronts meaningful challenges that test and hone the hero's ability as he strives for the cherished goal. The stages of the hero's journeys can be defined into 5 parts as follows. 1, conventional slumber, or the hero's life as a more or less conventional citizen. 2, the call to awakening and adventure. 3, the period of discipline and training. 4, the completion of the quest. And 5, the final phase of return and contribution to society. Let us now turn to the life of Joseph Smith and see to what extent his life corresponds to this universal template. Conventional slumber, or the hero's life as a more or less conventional citizen, or in Book of Mormon terms, the tradition of the fathers. In the first stage, the hero is born into a slumber within the conventions of society, much as do the rest of us. Society's beliefs are accepted as real, its morals regarded as appropriate, its limits seen as natural. This is the stage of conventionality, where most of us remain unquestioningly throughout our lives. This conventionality is traditionally said to be associated with an impaired, clouded state of mind. As I previously referred to, the tradition of the fathers, or a shared hypnosis or collective psychosis. This impairment or clouding of mind tends to go unnoticed because we all share in it. Joseph Smith and his mother present his early years as inconsequential. In his history, Joseph Smith factually mentions his birth date, place of birth, and the members of his family. His mother, Lucy, barely mentions Joseph's birth, afterwards stating, "In the meantime, we had a son named Joseph. After the name of his father, he was born December 23rd, 18 by and by." Joseph Smith's father was a visionary man, and he shared this reality with his son and family. Perhaps through his father's visions, Joseph vicariously recognized his ability to go beyond conventional limitations. not just simply reacting against social norms in blind countercultural defiance, but recognizing these limits and their distortions, the illusionary and arbitrary nature of his culture, and escaping from them and from the limited worldview of cultural, societal, and his family shared worldview, in the which Joseph matured from a limited worldview to a more universalistic perspective. No longer did he view life through limiting and distorting cultural biases, but rather he began to examine these biases and correct them. The correction of these biases is the final task of the hero. Before his final task, many other tasks must be completed. The first is to arise from the conventional or traditional slumber by responding to the call of awakening and adventure. At some stage, the hero's traditional slumber is challenged by a crisis of life-shattering proportions, an existential confrontation that calls all previously held beliefs into question. In the case of young Joseph Smith, it is personal sickness, as is related in Joseph's history by his mother, his childhood fever blisters on his body, and his leg operation on his leg. The experience of this operation conceivably changed Joseph's worldview to the extent that he began to question the state of the affairs of the world as they existed around him. Surviving such an operation was unheard of during this time. Perhaps Joseph, in this illness, recognized his ability to move beyond the norm. Joseph refused to react to the normal limitations imposed by his society. Instead, he became preactive or creative, insisting on an operation in an effort to save his leg, a prime example of countercultural defiance. So at the tender age of 8, Joseph refused to blindly accept the recommendations of the surgeon, but acted with his own natural knowing and moved beyond the conventional, creating another reality for him and his life, and thereby saving his leg. According to Joseph Smith's history, 6 years later, in the spring of 1820, after his family moved to Manchester, Joseph experienced an inner turmoil regarding the subject of religion. His family was divided between two sects, mainly the Presbyterians and the Methodists. He wondered which church he should join. Joseph Smith questioned the authority of the preachers and all of those around him. And as we know, by his famous story, he says, in the tumult of his opinions, I said to myself, who is right? And if they're all wrong, who's right and who should I join? This division in his family gnawed at him for some time, and he records that he was reading the Epistle of James, 1st chapter and 5th verse, which reads, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally, and upbraideth him not, and it shall be given him. Joseph reflected on it again, knowing that if any person needed wisdom from God, he did. For how to act, he did not know. And he would never know by an answer to the appeal to the Bible. Joseph received a call, and with this call faced a terrible dilemma. He had to choose whether to answer the call and move into the unknown realms of life that it demanded, or deny the call and retreat to the familiar. To deny the call would leave little choice for Joseph but to repress the message of James and its far-reaching implications. Only by such repressions can such a non-hero return to the alluring but narcotic comforts of conventional unconscious and entrancement. To sink into mediocrity, such a denial is no small matter. It is the basis of inauthentic living and alienation. To refuse the call is to be at risk of sickness, insanity, and even death. As Abraham Maslow has stated, if you deliberately plan to be less than you are capable of being, then I warn you that you will be deeply unhappy for the rest of your life. When the call is unanswered, it may lead to a process of rejection. If the purpose of life has changed, much that was previously viewed as valuable may no longer appear so and may be fitting to let it go. Status in society and one's possessions may be seen as obstacles rather than values. Joseph's understanding of the scripture and the deep feelings he felt moved him to action. Accepting the call to adventure and awakening, he was willing to do as James directs, and that is ask of God, which is precisely what he did. He reports that he retired to a woods to pray, and while he was praying, he was confronted by a dark obstacle which attempted to envelop him. As this dark force seized him, he reports, he was rescued by a light that descended from heaven, and in that light he saw two personages whose brightness and glory defied all description until it fell upon him. He found himself delivered from the darkness which bound him. When this light rested on him, he asked the personages in the air, said, calling him by name, he says, calling me by name, said, pointing to the other, this is my beloved son, hear him. Joseph's intention was to ask of God which of all the sects was right, that he might know which to join. No sooner, therefore, did he get possession of himself so as to be able to speak, that he asked the person who just stood above him in the light which of all the sects was right. He was told that he should join none of them, for they were all wrong, and that they were all corrupt and an abomination in the sight of God, and that their hearts are far from him, and that they taught the doctrine and the commandments of men, having a form of godliness, but they deny the power thereof. The personage forbade him again to join with any of them. and many other things that he said unto him, which he could not write at the time. Shortly after this experience, Joseph returned home and recited his experience to his family members, who straightway believed his account of this vision. The Smiths were a visionary family and freely accepted Joseph's visions. However, the same was not true for the local townsfolk or ministers. Joseph records in his history that a few days later, when he was speaking with a Methodist minister, he treated him lightly, with great contempt, saying it was all the devil, that there was no such thing as visions or revelations in these days, that all such things had ceased with the apostles, and that there would never be any more of them. He further states, I soon found, however, that my telling the story had excited a great deal of prejudice against me among professors of religion. Joseph Smith chose not to deny his call and maintained the vision as fact, stating that he felt as Paul before King Agrippa, that he did have a vision and that he knew it, and that he knew that God knew it, and he could not deny it. For who was he to deny the things of God? Joseph, like the hero, realized that to refuse his call could mean sickness, insanity, or even death. He was scorned for believing in his vision. His community accepted their conventional slumber and refused to accept his new awakening. I find it ironic that we call this the Second Great Awakening, this period of time, and that Joseph's here and these people refused to accept his awakening. Moving from the familiar to the unfamiliar, Joseph learned by his sad experience that not one of his ministers were willing to accept his call. As William W. Phelps wrote, "Praise to the man who communed with Jehovah, Jesus anointed that prophet and seer, blessed to open the last dispensation, kings shall extol him and nations revere." Joseph had indeed communed with God, preparing for the next phase of the hero's journey, that of discipline and training. For this, a teacher is usually essential, and so the phase of spurning may be followed by the search for a teacher. The teacher in this case plays the part of a trickster, possibly the most difficult test of his career. The hero's task is to seek out a teacher who is neither a fool or a fraud, and convince the teacher that he, the pupil, is worth teaching. His future development depends largely on the skill with which he performs his task. Once the teacher has been found, the phase of discipline and training begins. In the case of Joseph Smith, his teacher was not an earthly teacher, but as we know, an angel named Moroni, who appeared to him on the night of September 21st, 1823. Joseph reports that he was praying to ask God for forgiveness of his sins, feeling condemned for his weaknesses and imperfections. He prayed to Almighty God for forgiveness of his sins, and he wanted to know what his status was with God. For he had full confidence in obtaining a divine manifestation as he had previously done. Joseph fully expected a vision. While he was praying, he reports that a light filled his room, and in that light, an angel appeared, who said he was a messenger from God, and his name was Moroni. And then not far from his house, buried in a hill, was a record of gold plates. This record was an account of the ancient habits of America. Buried with this record were interpreters or seer stones. Joseph Smith reports that this messenger told him many things pertaining to himself and his life. For example, this messenger enlightened Joseph Smith's worldview, presenting him a much broader universal perspective. This messenger identified himself and told Joseph that God had a work for him to do, and that his name should be had for good and evil among all nations, kindred, tongues, and people, or that it should be both spoken of good and evil. Moroni expanded upon the scriptures, adding to them, even according to Joseph's account, quoting the verses differently, contributing to Joseph's scriptural knowledge, promising to reveal to him the hand of Elijah the prophet for the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Joseph recognized his task to go beyond the conventional limitations, further separating himself from society to a more universalistic perspective. This is the beginning of his examination and correction of cultural or social biases. Thus began his period of discipline and training. By whatever method, the aim is always the same, to train and cultivate the mind so as to reduce compulsions such as greed, hatred, and fear, to strengthen capacities such as will, concentration, and wisdom, and to cultivate emotions such as love, compassion, and joy. Joseph's training would become intense, beginning with Moroni appearing to him three times during the night and again the next day in his father's field. Shortly thereafter, Joseph reports that he retired to the hill which Moroni called Cumorah. There Joseph was shown the plates of gold. Immediately, Joseph's first instinct was to retrieve the plates to get gain to help pay off his parents' debts. According to one account, Joseph attempted to remove the plates and was jolted with an electric shock. Moroni tutored Joseph about the contrast of good and evil and the consequences of both obedience and disobedience to the commandments of God, which left an indelible impression upon his mind. Joseph agreed to return every year for the next 4 years, and according to Joseph, was tutored by Moroni in the ways of God during each visit. Shortly after this, Joseph acquired the reputation of being a money digger or a glass looker, searching for lost objects and for further treasures in the earth, all to provide a living for himself and his family, all the while honing his newly acquired spiritual talent in preparation for that which was to come. During Joseph's money-digging adventures, he became acquainted with Emma Smith, who he married on January 18, 1827. In spite of Emma's parents' opposition to their union, Joseph found an equal, a soulmate, who was willing to go beyond or outside of societal norms and marry her beloved. 9 months later, the time had arrived for Joseph to obtain the place on the hill. On the night of September 21st, 22nd, 1827, Joseph received the place from Moroni with a charge that Joseph should be responsible for them and that he would be cut off if he should let them go carelessly. This charge was strict, for there were reasons to know that strenuous exertions would soon be made to try to get the place from him. During the early hours of the morning, shortly after he left the hill, Joseph was assaulted by an angry mob who attempted to steal the place. This was only the beginning of several attempts over the ensuing months to obtain the place from Joseph by means of necromancy by Sally Chase, Samuel Lawrence, and others. The Smiths had to constantly be on guard at their home, moving the plates from place to place as Joseph was directed by his spiritual gift. Others in his neighborhood had heard of Joseph's plight and decided to ally themselves with him in his endeavor to translate the plates, examples being the Knight family, the Hales, the Whitmers, and Morton Harris. Beginning in December 1827 and continuing to June 1828, Joseph Smith translated a portion of his record with Morton Harris acting as the primary scribe. Lucy Harris, Martin's wife, was curious as to why Martin was spending so much time with Smith. She insisted that Martin spend time with her working on their farm. Martin related to Joseph the story of to Lucy the story of Joseph Smith and his involvement with the translation of the record. Lucy became furious and insisted on seeing the plates, ransacking the Smith's home, searching for the plates. Shortly thereafter, in spite of his best judgment, Joseph Smith lent Martin Harris the manuscript they had translated, thus far consisting of 116 pages. In late June 1828, early July, the 116 pages of the Book of Lehi were borrowed from Joseph by Martin Harris, who took them to Palmyra to show them to his wife and family, and they were lost. Lucy Smith and others suspected that Martin Harris's wife, Lucy, stole the 116 pages. On June 15, 1827, Joseph and Emma's first son, Alvin, was born, who died shortly thereafter. After the death of their firstborn son, Emma's life hung in the balance. Joseph being told by those caring for Emma that she was nigh unto death, Joseph remained with Emma for 2 weeks, all the while pondering on the whereabouts of Martin Harris and the 116 pages. Leaving for his father's farm in New York, once there, he asked Martin to come to his father's house to tell him what happened to the 116 pages. Martin reluctantly told Joseph that the pages were lost. Joseph feared that he would be cut off, as Moroni had previously told him, or worse, suffer some sort of sickness or even death, if not his own, perhaps that of his wife. Shortly thereafter, Moroni retrieved the interpreters and the plates. Joseph returned to Harmony and stayed for nearly 2 months. There the spectacles were returned to him long enough to receive revelation from the Lord, chastising him for allowing the counsel of thy directors to be trampled upon, and assuring him that nevertheless my work shall go forth. Subsequently, on September 22nd, Moroni returned the plates to Joseph to continue the work of translation. In the winter of 1828 and spring of 29, Joseph translated a little. In April 1828, Oliver Cowdery arrived in Harmony to teach school. Members of the community informed Oliver about Joseph and his plates. Oliver, not willing to accept the vicious community rumors, decided to visit Joseph to discover the truth of those matters. Upon hearing Joseph's story, Oliver himself, a seeker, embraced Joseph's story and agreed to assist in the translation of the book. Oliver Cowdery and Joseph Smith would share many pivotal experiences together during the next 10 years, beginning with the translation of the Book of Mormon and the visitation of angels, such as John the Baptist, Peter, James, and John, who restored the keys or power and authority to act in the name of God. In Oliver, Joseph found a pupil who was willing to bear all that he bore. The pupil had become the teacher and was prepared to complete his quest for religious authority. Joseph and Oliver completed the translation in July of 1829. Martin Harris, perhaps acting out of a feeling of regret for having lost 116 pages, agreed to mortgage his farm for the publication of the Book of Mormon. With the publication of the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith was prepared for the culmination of his quest, the next stage in his journey. Truly, Joseph's sacrifices did bring forth the blessings of heaven. The world needed awakening, so wake up the world for the conflict of justice. Millions shall know Brother Joseph again. Joseph's years of discipline and tutelage culminated in breakthroughs of life-changing proportions, not only for himself, but those of his followers. Joseph's reputation spread throughout his community, and those who had experiences similar to his were seeking after him, requesting further light and knowledge. This enlightenment was provided by Joseph to those seekers in the form of revelations or visions, insights, etc. In the language of the near-death experience, insights into death and rebirth, such as Doctrine and Covenant, Section 19, enlightening his followers with a sense of liberation or a union with God with personal revelations. Such experiences are beyond words, ineffable, sublime, beyond this world, beyond description, and yes, even beyond thought. For Joseph and his followers, such experiences are the goal and the highest good of their existence. While there are some periods of what is called the transcendental unity of religion, there are also significant differences between religions and the type and depth of relativistic experience. The Smiths, Whitmers, and others preached the message of Joseph's story throughout their surrounding countryside. A number of people identified with Joseph's experience and wished to unify themselves with him in his quest for God. The price for the unity at first was just to believe on Christ and receive a forgiveness of the sins, and after the appearance of John the Baptist, to be baptized for the remission of those sins. Soon, Joseph's modest band of followers would be baptized by the Smiths and others. It soon became apparent that these baptisms would not be sufficient to bind and unify this community. Therefore, it was decided that the community bind itself together as a church. And on April 6, 1830, the Church of Christ was organized in upstate New York. Joseph Smith's quest for religious authority being now fulfilled, it was time to return and contribute to a society the things he had learned. For great is his glory and endless his priesthood. Ever and ever the keys he will hold. Faithful and true, he will enter his kingdom, crowned in the midst of the prophets of old. With his quest for answers now complete, Joseph became the knower, the pupil, a teacher, the student, a sage. With his own questions answered, the world's chaos pleads to be organized. With his own suffering relieved, the pain and sorrow of the world cries out for healing. And with his own egocentric motives reduced, the desire to contribute becomes central and completing. Joseph's direction now reverses. Whereas previously he had formally turned away from society and into himself, he now returns back to society and out into the world, stating, "I intend to lay a foundation that will revolutionize the whole world." Joseph tamed the spirits of Moroni, John the Baptist, Peter, James, and John, and others for the benefit of his followers. Joseph returned to heal and help the world. His spiritual marriage with God complete, his life flowed out to other men. This divine love he described as follows. Love is one of the chief characteristics of deity and ought to be manifested by those who aspire to be the sons of God. A man filled with the love of God is not content with the blessings with blessing his family alone, but ranges through the whole world, anxious to bless the whole human race. Joseph accepted the pains and duties in the place of rapture, of the rapture of love. Joseph became a source, a parent, of fresh spiritual life. Joseph lived among his people as the center of transcendental energy, something equivalent to the solitude in the wilderness from which he returned. Joseph, having established his communion, reordered his inner life upon his transcendental level, and being united with the source, not merely in temporary ecstasies, but in virtue of a permanent condition of his soul, he was impelled to abandon his solitude and resume in some way his contact with the outside world in order to become the medium or prophet whereby the life flowed out to other men. To go up alone into the mountain, be it Cumorah or another, and come back as an ambassador to the world, has ever been the method of humanity's best friends. Joseph's return is what Arnold Toynbee called withdrawal and return. Toynbee found that this cycle was common to those people who had the most beneficial impact on human society. Such people, like our Joseph Smith, live in both worlds, inner and outer, transcendental and mundane. Joseph had access to the transcendental depths within, but worked to translate and express them in the world outside through his revelations and the Book of Mormon. With the organization of the church, Joseph Smith had the capacity and the method to return his followers to the presence of God. So accordingly, his followers were commanded to build a temple. And in this temple, Israel's keys were to be restored. Once again, as with the restoration of priesthood keys and blessings, Oliver Cowdery was his companion. The temple was built in Kirtland, Ohio, and dedicated on April 3, 1836. On this date, Joseph Smith records a vision known as Doctrine and Covenants 10, with the Lord appearing first to them, followed by Moses, who committed the keys of the gathering of Israel, Elias, who committed the keys of the dispensation of the gospel of Abraham, and Elijah, who was taken into heaven without tasting death. Reiterating the same scripture that Moroni had rehearsed to Joseph a few years previously, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children to the fathers, lest the whole earth be smitten with a curse. The keys of this dispensation were committed in the hands of Joseph and Oliver. This great day of Pentecost ensued for a short season. The mobs again were enraged and drove the saints from pillar to post, from Kirtland to Missouri, finally settling in Nauvoo, Illinois. In Nauvoo, the saints yearned for a reunion of the spirit they had experienced in Kirtland. So in harmony with their wishes, they were commanded to build a greater temple to be endowed with power from on high. Here in Nauvoo, Joseph would complete the restoration of the blessings of Elijah and Elias. Sealing the saints together with the heavens, Joseph Smith introduced the doctrines of baptism for the dead, eternal marriage, plural marriage, and sealings of the holy anointing. These ordinances are a consistent continuation of the doctrines and ordinances first revealed at the dedication of the Kirtland Temple in April 3, 1836. In the fall of 1830, Joseph Smith taught Joseph Noble privately about plural marriage. And on April 5th, he married his first plural wife in Nauvoo, Louisa Beeman, with Noble officiating. In July of 1841, he revealed that Brigham Young, Heber C. Kimball, and John Taylor, the principal of plural marriage. Publicly, Joseph announced on August 15, 1840, at the funeral of Seymour Brunson, that the Lord would permit the saints to be baptized in behalf of their friends and relatives who had departed this life. On September 12, 1840, the first baptisms for the dead were performed in the Mississippi River. On January 19th, he received a revelation commanding them to build a temple and a baptismal font. On November 8, 1841, Brigham Young dedicated this spot at the Nauvoo Temple. On January 6, 1842, Joseph Smith's history records the following. Truly, this is the day of days in which the God of heaven has begun to restore the ancient order of his kingdom, a day in which God has begun to make manifest and set in order his church, those things which wise men desire to see, a day in which those things begin to be made manifest, which have been hid from before the foundation of the world, a kingdom of priests and kings, all of which is to come to pass in the restitution of all things. On this day, the first sealing for time and all eternity took place in the upstairs of Joseph Smith's store. This marriage of Agnes Culber Smith to Joseph Smith was a sealing for time, perhaps an early proxy marriage in which Agnes was sealed to Don Carlos for eternity, with Joseph standing as proxy for his dead brother, followed by Agnes being sealed to Joseph for time. Agnes was the first widow Joseph married, the first of four. Since Agnes was the widow of Joseph, this would be a Joseph's brother Don Carlos, this would be a strict Old Testament Levirate marriage. Joseph was interested in the restoration of all biblical doctrines and practices in this, the dispensation of the fullness of times. And he therefore may have seen great significance in the performance in modern times of such a biblical custom. Truly this was a day of days to which the saints looked forward for anticipation. At last the marriage of heaven and earth was complete. The sealing was a foreshadowing of what would occur 5 months later when Joseph Smith would introduce the endowment. On May 4th, Joseph Smith organized the Quorum of the Anointed, or the Holy Order of the Priesthood. This is the realization of the day alluded to previously. On this day, Joseph Smith administered the endowment to Brigham Young, Heber C. Kimball, Willard Richards, and six others. On the 5th of May, Brigham Young administered these blessings to Joseph and Hiram. The restoration of priesthood blessings was now complete. Of the endowment and the sealing blessings, Joseph Smith wrote, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, if a man marry a wife, according to my word, and they are sealed by the Holy Spirit of promise, according to mine appointment, they shall come forth in the first resurrection and enter into their exaltation." Joseph Smith could rest for a little while and teach his leaders the spiritual things, testing his leaders as he was tested by Moroni and others some 20 years previously. Perhaps the most dynamic test is one that I've chosen to explore here. In the spring of 1842 in Nauvoo, Illinois, rumors were circulating about Joseph Smith's brother, William Smith, one of the first quorum of apostles in this age, that he had been guilty of adultery and many other sins. At this time, Joseph had taught a handful of saints about the principle of plural marriage. Rumors were rampant among the saints about the leaders of the church regarding this new principle, some being accused of adultery and many other sins. Rumors based on innuendo are a very dangerous thing. Brigham Young discussed these charges of innuendo and rumor with Joseph Smith. The prophet Joseph instructed Brigham, then the president of the 12, to prefer a charge against the sinner, which was done. Before the time set for the trial, however, Emma Smith talked to Joseph and said the charge preferred against William was with a view to injuring the Smith family. On May 25, 1842, after the trial had begun, Joseph entered the room and was given a seat. The testimony of witnesses concerning the culprit's sin was then continued. After a short time, Joseph arose, filled with wrath, and said, "Brother Brigham, I will not listen to this abuse of my family a minute longer. I will wade in blood up to my knees before I will do it." This was a supreme moment. A rapture between the two greatest men on earth seemed imminent. But Brigham Young was equal to the danger, and he instantly said, "Brother Joseph, I withdraw the charge." Thus the angry passions were stilled instantly. Shortly after this episode, Joseph Smith was forced to flee Nauvoo due to John Bennett and others' vicious rumors about and trying to blacken the undermining the okay, sorry.
A lot louder and a little slower.
Okay. I have a lot to go through, that's why I'm okay. All right. Blackened Joseph's reputation and undermined the church and subject him to Joseph's old Missouri enemies. The sheriff arrived seeking to arrest Joseph, who shortly thereafter disappeared. Joseph went into hiding for the next few months in and around Nauvoo, sometimes camping out on an island in the Mississippi River. In the fall of 1842, Joseph Smith was informed of Brigham Young's condition. Brigham was very ill and appeared to be near death. Joseph, at the peril of his life, visited Brigham Young in November 1842. Brigham Young recorded that he was attacked with a sickness of epilepsy. His skin literally fell off his body. and he was real sick. He was attacked with a violent fever, and Joseph and Willard Richards visited with him and administered to him. And Joseph promised Brigham that he would live and recover from the sickness, and he sat with him for 6 hours and directed Dr. Foster on what he should do. And about 2 days later, skin began to peel from his body, and he wanted to be baptized in the river, but Joseph wouldn't let him. And a few days later, he was baptized on the 18th of November. Soon the days of Joseph's testings were complete. At a council in the latter part of the month of March, 1842, held in the city of Nauvoo, 1844, excuse me, held in the city of Nauvoo, and on the red brick store, Joseph seemed somewhat depressed in spirit and took the liberty to open his heart to us concerning his presentments of the future. His own language to us on that occasion was as follows: "Brethren, the Lord bids me hasten the work in which we are engaged. He will not suffer that you should wait for your endowment until the temple is done. Some important scene is near to take place. It may be that my enemies will kill me, and in case they should, and the keys and power which rest on me not be imparted to you, they will be lost in the earth. But if I can only succeed in placing them upon your heads, then let me fall a victim to murderous hands if God will suffer it, and I can go, with all pleasures and satisfactions, knowing that my work is done, and the foundation laid on which the kingdom of God is to be reared in this dispensation, the fullness of times. Upon the shoulders of the 12 must be the responsibility of leading the church. Henceforth, rest upon you, shall appoint others to succeed you. Your enemies cannot kill you all at once, and should any of you be killed, you can lay your hands upon others to fill up your quorum. Thus can this power and these keys be perpetuated in the earth. Brethren, you have many storms to pass through, and many sore trials await you. You will know what it is to be bound with chains and with fetters for this cause's sake. God knows I pity you on the earth, and I feel for you. But if you are called to lay down your lives, die like men, and pass immediately beyond the reach of your enemies. After they have killed you, they can harm you no more. Should you live, should you have to walk right into danger in the jaws of death, fear no evil. Jesus Christ has died before you." After this appointment was made, the 12 received the holy anointing in the hands of Joseph and Hiram. Joseph continued his speech, saying, "While he walked the floor and threw back the collar of his coat upon his shoulders, I roll the burden and responsibility of leading this church off from my shoulders onto yours. Now round up your shoulders and stand under it like men, for the Lord is going to let me rest in a while. Since I have rolled the burden off my shoulders, I feel as light as a cork. I feel that I am free." Shortly after this, Joseph Smith preached the most significant funeral sermon in Mormonism, that we now know as the King Follett Sermon, teaching the saints about the character of God in preparation for the reception of temple blessings. 2 months later, on a sultry afternoon at a place called Carthage Jail, on the 27th of June, 1844, Joseph and Hiram were killed. Now the journey of the hero was complete. Death could not conquer the hero again. Now praised to his memory, he died as a martyr. Honored and blessed be his ever great name. Long shall his blood, which was shed by assassins, stay in Illinois while the earth lauds his fame. Hail to the prophet, ascended to heaven. Traitors and tyrants now fight him in vain. Mingling with gods, he can plan for his brethren. Death cannot conquer the hero again. This, then, is only a brief overview of one form of the hero's journey. This journey has been played out with countless variations over countless years and countless cultures. Its greatest players, the great saints and sages, have been said to represent the highest development and fullest flowering of human potential and have the greatest impact on human history. So at least have said the historians Toynbee, the philosopher Bergson, Schopenhauer, and Nietzsche, as well as the psychologists James, Maslow, and Wilbur. Many heroes start out on the path, but few attain the greatest heights. Nor is the journey always a circle or withdrawal and return. Instead, in the case of Joseph Smith, it consists of a series of circles like a spiral in which one returns again and again, but each time to a higher vantage point with a greater perspective. The hero's journey is then not limited solely to great saints and sages, but rather it is available to all of us to greater or lesser degrees, depending on the sincerity with which we undertake it. Perhaps Joseph Campbell and Bill Moyers put it best when speaking of myth as a lie. Campbell replied to Moyers, "No, mythology is not a lie, it is poetry. It is metaphorical. It has been well said that mythology is the penultimate truth. Penultimate because the ultimate cannot be put into words. It is beyond words, beyond images, beyond that bounding rim of the Buddhist will of becoming. Mythology pitches the mind beyond the rim so that what can be known but not told, so this is the penultimate truth." I'm missing a page. It's important to live life with the experiences and therefore the knowledge of its mysteries and of your own mystery. This gives life a new radiance, a new harmony, a new splendor. Thinking in mythological terms helps to put you in accordance with the inevitabilities of this veil of tears. You learn to recognize the positive values in what appear to be the negative moments and aspects of your life. The big question is whether you are going to be able to say a hearty yes to your adventure. The adventure of the hero. Yes, the adventure of the hero. That adventure of being alive. It is my hope that those of you here today have found some answer to your questions about Joseph Smith. Perhaps the answers to Jan Shipps's The Prophet puzzle can be found in my interpretation of Joseph Smith and the hero's journey. Thank you.